On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Andrew Doss about remarriage, especially in the early church. So we cover all sorts of topics like, what is remarriage? Was it ever actually permitted in the early church? Is there a consensus view that has shaped both that period and our own contemporary scholarship? What is that? Are there circumstances that are relevant for when a divorce might allow for a case of remarriage and when it might not? Are there actual biblical grounds for divorce? Are there biblical grounds for remarriage? What are we to make of the exception clauses that we seem to find in Scripture? What about Matthew 5:32? And what about Matthew 19:9 and other texts? What sort of background material might be actually relevant to understanding what Jesus means? And how much weight should we give to things like background information? And a whole lot more. If you can't tell, we cover a lot of information, and it is a blast. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook, or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak. And we are a podcast that is dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And in thinking seriously, we've tried to cultivate and encourage an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So if you're brand new to the podcast, you'll find that we talk to all sorts of people about all sorts of topics, because we think that helps us to think better and more clearly. And we try to treat people with respect and honor, even where we disagree, because I think that develops the right sorts of habits of mind. So hopefully we do that all the time, whether we agree or not. And this gives us the opportunity to talk about lots of interesting topics, too. And today we're going to be talking about a fun one with Dr. Andrew Doss about remarriage, particularly in early Christianity. And I think I first was introduced to Dr. Doss's work through, I took a Greek exegesis course of Galatians. And so I got to read one of his commentary on Galatians. And it's been, I don't know, it's probably like 12 or 13 years since that happened now. It's been a while. I don't know, maybe it's been shorter than that. I don't remember when it was. It was during my master's degree. Either way, I found there that I really enjoyed his writing. And then I find this book that just is coming out here, I guess, as we're recording this. It came out last month. So I'll drop a link to it in the show notes. So if you're interested in it, you can go ahead and get a copy and support his work there. But there's lots of interesting stuff in here. So I want to get to the topic. So Andrew, before we do anything, tell me a little bit about who you are and yourself, and then what was it that was the impetus for writing this book?
Well, thank you for having me. I serve as the Niebuhr Distinguished Chair and Professor of Religious Studies here at Elmhurst University in the Chicago area. I'm the author or editor of over 10 books in biblical studies, especially the Apostle Paul, the commentary on Galatians you mentioned from 2014 from Concordia Publishing House, but then most recently, this remarriage in early Christianity that's come out and is now available from Eerdmans. And you asked me what led me to write this book. And to tell you a little bit of the story, it was the late 1980s. I was serving as the editor of my seminary's student theology journal. And a student had just finished his master's thesis and sent a paper to the journal. And apparently a new book had just come out a few years earlier, 1984, titled Jesus and Divorce, by Gordon Wenham and William Heth. And they'd taken the position that remarriage after divorce was strictly forbidden by Jesus. And I had never heard that point of view before. I mean, my own church tradition has always held that remarriage is permitted for the innocent party to divorce. And the student was struggling with whether the original text of Matthew 19:9 really does have an exception clause in it for divorce or remarriage. Turns out that the earliest and the best Greek manuscripts disagree. And while I agreed that a strong case can be made for an exception clause, I was just troubled in the paper how he had listed several of the earliest Christian authors prior to the Council of Nicaea in AD 325, and every one of them had denied that remarriage after divorce is possible. So our remarriage of innocent parties seemed at odds with the teachings of the first Christians, and that bothered me. I mean, after all, the New Testament has these strong statements against divorce remarriage. One of them is in Mark chapter 10, 11 and 12, and Jesus says there, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And also, she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. So Jesus just labels any divorce or remarriage an act of adultery. And so as a pastor, I certainly wouldn't want to be complicit in adultery. Well, about 10 years later, the issue came up again with two close friends of mine who were in the ministry and both married recently divorced women. And I just couldn't find a way in the Bible to justify remarriage after divorce. And if that's adultery, then we as Christians wouldn't want to be leading people into adultery by our teaching and by our practice. So the stakes here are awfully high in discussion, whether you agree with me or not.
Yeah. And I think the first time I was introduced to these sorts of topics, it was a course that I was assigned in an undergrad, actually, in a New Testament backgrounds course. And one of the assigned texts was David Enstone Brewer's book on divorce and remarriage. So I would think, if I recall correctly, he would be taking a very different approach than like what the earliest Christians would say, right?
Yeah, so we should back up a little bit and take our jumping point from Enstone Brewer's contribution here. In the first century Mediterranean world, as David Enstone Brewer well documented, a Greek or a Roman husband in divorcing a wife would give her a certificate. And this was a future potential husband would know that the wife had been, quote, freed by her husband. That was the language that the certificates would use. So the potential new husband would be reassured by this, that he wasn't violating another man's wife. But it wasn't just a Greek or a Roman practice, and Enstone Brewer is helpful here as well. I mean, the Jews around the year 200 created a document called the Mishnah, their interpretations of the Torah of Moses. And one of the tractates in the Mishnah is called Gittin. It's named after the Jewish bill of divorce, their divorce certificates. So Jewish men, upon divorce, would give their wives these certificates, and it was supposed to read, "You are a freed woman. You belong to yourself." The wife was now, quote, free. She could marry someone else. And we even have examples that have survived these certificates, and they mention the same freedom that we see in the Greek and the Roman divorce certificates. And you remember, in Deuteronomy 24, verse 4, when a man divorces his wife, he's supposed to give her that certificate. And so we actually have examples of these certificates, as Enstone Brewer documented for us, going all the way back to the Assyrians, in 1400 BC, the later Babylonians, and they would always pronounce the wife, quote, free to marry again or to go wherever she wishes. And so by the time we get to Jesus in the first century, Josephus, our Jewish historian of that period, talks about how husbands could divorce their wives, but they were supposed to give them that divorce certificate. So this was Jewish practice. It was the same as the Greek and the Roman. And so divorce and remarriage were largely permitted in their world. But that's what brings into stark relief what Jesus will say culturally in Mark chapter 10, verses 11 to 12. Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. Also, she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. So this is really unexpected. It's very against the grain of the surrounding world. And Mark places this astounding saying smack dab in the middle of a section of the gospel on discipleship. So discipleship's tough, it's demanding, but at the end of the day, Jesus says what's impossible for human beings is possible for God. So God enables that challenging life of discipleship, even when we're adhering to Jesus' teaching about divorce and remarriage. Now, we want to ask about the first Christians here as well, because they're taking their lead from Jesus' countercultural teaching. So in the first 300 years of Christianity, it turns out that no Christian author advocated for remarriage after divorce. A good case study here would be the Shepherd Hermas. It was written to the Roman church in the early part of the second century. So an angel reveals to Hermas that after divorce, the spouses must remain single or repent and be reconciled to their former partners. I mean, if you look at it, it's the same thing that the Lord commanded in the Apostle Paul's letter to the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 7, 10 to 11. But what's interesting is that Hermas then struggles mightily, not with remarriage after divorce, but whether remarriage is possible if a spouse has died. In fact, it takes even an angelic revelation to him to calm his nerves about the possibility of remarrying when a spouse has died. So that was the hot issue for him, not remarriage after divorce. That just wasn't a possibility. Well, shift forward a couple decades. Justin Martyr, in the middle of the second century, condemns the twice remarried as sinners, all in the context, twice married as sinners, all in the context of quoting Matthew 5:32 about divorce or remarriage. And there's nothing here about an innocent party. It's just sin. In the latter half of the second century, Athenagoras writes that a person should either remain as he was born or be content with one marriage. for a second marriage is only a specious adultery. And so what you see then is that even modern advocates of remarriage, like David Ensign Brewer, will note how regularly the early Christians in these centuries would call remarriage after divorce adulterous. So there's agreement that this was the position of the first Christians.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So there's like the way you've described it, there's really a consensus prior to Jesus of, you know, it's permissible, even in the Jewish context. And then the early church seems to have a completely different view and understanding based upon the words of Jesus. And they're not drawing on any other sources to make these claims, are they?
Not that we know of. I mean, there are some antecedents for this strict position in their world. And we'll talk about that in a bit, probably. But on the whole, not enough to render this anything other than striking teaching.
So over the last couple of decades, the consensus view, it seems to me that it would probably more lean towards divorce or remarriage as permissible. Why would they be taking that approach? Are they relying on different sources saying, you know, the early church is just confused? And how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, Protestants have emphasized since the Reformation and with the humanist Erasmus that Jesus' teaching against remarriage would have permitted an exception for the innocent party. Whether the guilty spouse had adulterated or decided unilaterally to divorce, the innocent party would be free in these situations to remarry. But the question really is the notion of an innocent party scriptural? And so we have to ask that question. And the answer is, well, yes, but also no. I mean, Matthew in his gospel records Jesus making an exception to Jesus' strict prohibition of divorce. And this has been very influential in our modern churches. So Jesus says in Matthew 5:32, I say to you that anyone who divorces his wife except on the ground of unchastity or sexual sin causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So what can we conclude? Well, divorce is adulterous, but Jesus is making an exception here when the wife is guilty of sexual sin. So the husband would here be an innocent party since the wife was a guilty one. So in that case, the husband may divorce his wife with no worry about also being guilty of sin. I mean, after all, how could he cause her in divorce to commit adultery if she already has? So there are innocent parties in divorce, but are the innocent parties then permitted to remarry? And that's the real question. And Matthew does not say that here. Now, he does talk about remarriage in the second part of the verse in Matthew 5:32. So may a man marry a divorced woman? Well, no, says Jesus, or you would be committing adultery. And notice that Jesus doesn't say whether the woman is herself innocent or guilty. It just doesn't matter. If you're marrying a woman who's divorced, regardless of the circumstances, you're adulterating, period. Well, Paul records Jesus' teaching as well and has Jesus saying really the same. So in 1 Corinthians 7, 10-11, to the married I give this command, not I but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does separate, let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not divorce his wife. I mean, it's a shocking couple of verses in a world of whether it's the ancient world or even for us. And so once again, we get that twofold command that there is to be no divorce, whether by the husband or by the wife. But Jesus still nevertheless envisions that a divorce may take place. And if it does, there could be no remarriage to another partner. All that's permitted is reconciliation and return to the former spouse. So there's nothing here about any of the spouses being innocent. It's just irrelevant as far as the remarriage is concerned.
I mean, as I think about that, it would solve a lot of the thorny pastoral questions of what to do after a divorce if it were cleaner like this. Now, in the case of a death, do they use the same logic? So let's say your spouse dies. Are they free to remarry in that case?
Yeah, I mean, Paul will address this situation in a couple passages. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, 39 to 40, and also in Romans chapter 7, 2 to 3, he'll talk about how a wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if the spouse dies, then she is, quote, free. You hear the language of certificates there. She's free to marry another, although he'll say in 1 Corinthians 7:39 that this person needs to be in the Lord, needs to be a fellow believer. But this is the one instance that Scripture clearly gives us where someone may, who's been married, can marry again. And notice that it's consistently in these cases after the death of a spouse.
Okay. So when I think about Matthew 5 and Matthew 19 in particular, and how Jesus sort of frames the question, like does Matthew 19:9, does that in any sense offer an exception in some level to where maybe it's providing an avenue for remarriage?
I think that's our best candidate, Matthew 19, verse 9. The problem, though, here is just that the grammar of the verse isn't entirely clear. So what you have here is you have Matthew's Jesus placing an exception clause between two verbs, one for divorce and the second for remarriage. So the verse reads, "I tell you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery." So the question we have here is whether this exception clause modifies only the first verb, permitting divorce, or whether it also modifies the second, permitting remarriage. And we have a slew of very good Matthean commentators who think that the exception clause really only modifies the first. But there are a number of reasons why that is likely the case. It's what's called here a Matthean doublet, or repeated teaching. So Matthew, as we were just talking about, had talked about divorce from marriage earlier in Matthew 5:32. And what you find in Matthew's gospel is that the second of these doublets, this repeated teaching, will typically restate or shorten what was the content of the first. Now, we had a prohibition of divorce in Matthew 5:32, but we had an exception there. And then we had a prohibition of remarriage with no exception. Well, that's how we should take Matthew chapter 19. And also, notice that the exception clause is placed between the verbs, not after them both. So between the two verbs instead of after indicates that it modifies really only the first. There are several grammatical indications that it's modifying what comes just before. So the understood verb for this exception would be what had just preceded, except the man divorces his wife for adultery. So the indicators are all there. They're pointing to the exception only being for the divorce, with no exception being made for remarriage here. And that then would agree perfectly with Jesus' teaching in Matthew 5, with Luke 16:18, Mark 10:11-12, or 1 Corinthians 7:10-11. They would all be in consistent agreement. We just wouldn't have a permission for remarriage here. And that's what's difficult for us.
Okay, that's helpful. So as I think about the background material that is often marshaled with these discussions and trying to understand what Jesus means, how much weight should we be giving to the background material versus the text that we've been given here in the Gospels and other places?
Yeah, we've talked about excellent scholars who've written books on the cultural acceptance of divorce or remarriage in that ancient world, Greek, Roman, and Jewish. But I think it's precisely that information, that demonstrated widespread acceptance of divorce or remarriage, that causes Jesus' teaching against both to stand out. It's all the more striking, it's shocking, precisely because it's so countercultural. We don't even have any record of Jewish teachers prior to 70 even really debating the grounds for divorce. I mean, Hillel and Shammai, it may even be anachronistic retrojection, if you will, of a later rabbinic position on this matter that's been pushed back into that time period. Now, we do have a few parallels to a strict position against remarriage. We do find it in the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the fragments of the Damascus document. There's a fragment there that rules out remarriage for people except for the death of a spouse. We find it in the Roman traditions of the Univira, and also in some Greek inscriptions in the East where the spouses remain faithful to the partner for the lifetime of the partner. It's enough to show that Jesus' teaching is not unprecedented, but it's not enough to remove the shock value in the ancient world that was otherwise very accepting of divorce from marriage. So ultimately here, we have to let the biblical witness speak on its own terms, even when it's not what we in our own day would want it to say.
So I want to understand the relationship here between what Jesus is teaching and what Paul is teaching, especially in 1 Corinthians 7. Because the way I've heard that explained is it seems that Paul is being a little bit more specific about exceptions in some ways. you know, where he gives the in such cases, you know, if the unbelieving partner separates, where I've seen people like Wayne Grudem argue that in such cases refers to all sorts of egregious sins to where now they're free in some sense to remarry. How should we interpret that?
Yeah, I mean, 1 Corinthians 7:15, the verse you're just quoting, it's sometimes called the Pauline permission, if you will, and it's used for both divorce, understood both for divorce, but also for remarriage. So we really need to talk about both divorce and remarriage. Is Paul making a permission here in certain circumstances where remarriage would be allowed? And so you find all these treatments of remarriage in Christianity where it's not just a divorce he's allowing, but also the remarriage of that partner. But Wayne Grudem really sharpened our thinking on this in 2019 a bit when he would justify divorce in situations beyond adultery and beyond when an unbeliever insists on it, which is what Paul's talking about here in 1 Corinthians 7:12-16. And so he seizes on the phrase in such cases. You remember Paul writes in that verse, but if the unbeliever leaves, let him leave. A brother or sister is not bound in such cases. Well, Grudem's claiming that that phrase, in such cases, would refer to more than just desertion, let's say, by an unbelieving spouse. Even that's the only instance he's talking about in the context. So you have to ask yourself, well, how does he get there? Well, the phrase, in such cases, is not used anywhere else in the New Testament. It's not used anywhere else in the Greek translation of the Old Testament. So in other Greek literature from antiquity, Grudem finds that in such cases is used with plural antecedents, and this is important, sometimes to mean in these cases and others that are related in some way. But Grudem's going to grant that in other places it just means in cases just like these. So in other words, the context will tell you whether the author is looking to instances beyond the ones given or is limited to them. So Grudem then turns to in such cases with a singular antecedent. And he lists seven examples in antiquity where in such cases refers to those beyond the one mentioned. And I haven't had a chance to replicate his research for myself or to study his text. I mean, you can tell from the title of my book, I'm working with remarriage in early Christianity, not with the grounds for divorce. But let me at least say this. If the plural antecedent is any indication, context is going to remain king in the interpretation of the phrase. So you have to ask yourself, what's a context that greets us here in 1 Corinthians 15? I mean, several times in the prior verses, going back to the verse 10, Jesus and Paul prohibit divorce to take place. It's a strong, repeated, emphatic prohibition. But what are you to do when it's out of your control and an unbelieving spouse is insisting on it? And that's where Paul says, if the unbeliever leaves, well, let him leave. A brother or sister is not bound in such cases. So in other words, what you see here is that Paul is struggling mightily across six verses up to this point. And to get here. And it's only because a believer is left no choice. In this context, and again, context is king, in these cases, most naturally refers to the unbeliever forcing divorce on a believer. So it's very strange to me. It's in my mind disturbing when Paul is struggling mightily to justify a divorce in an instance, in this particular instance, to Grudem's finding all sorts of justifiable reasons for divorce. So Grudem ends up taking Paul's repeated admonitions not to divorce and really effectively reverses it. But then what about remarriage? Well, what about that part of the verse? Well, people overlook that Paul never even mentions remarriage here in verses 12 to 16. It's just not a topic he's talking about. Well, people say, well, wait a minute. I mean, in verse 15, he says that a divorced spouse is not bound in these instances. Doesn't that mean she can marry again? So here we focus on the now not bound part of the verse. But hold on for a second. Paul didn't actually say that the spouse is not bound. He uses bound language for marriage. He didn't say not bound, but had he said that the believer is not, quote, bound, well, then maybe remarriage would be possible. But Paul reserves not bound for 1 Corinthians 7:39. Romans 7:2-3 for the widow. And it says that she is, quote, free to marry again since her spouse has died and she's not bound. It's the only place where Paul permits remarriage. But if you look at verse 15 of 1 Corinthians 7 here, there's no freedom language. And remember, that was characteristic of the divorce certificates. You don't have that language. It's not here. And he uses the word not enslaved instead of not bound. I mean, he appears in his wording to be avoiding the very conclusion that people are wanting to make. So then you ask yourself, well, why did Paul choose not enslaved? Well, as you look at Paul's letters, he's going to talk about slavery under the law all through his letters. And we have a sort of law, don't we, here in verses 10 to 15? I mean, listen to how often Paul urges that no divorce is to take place. I mean, it's over and over again. The wife is not to divorce her husband. A husband is not to divorce his wife. He must not divorce her. She must not divorce her husband. It's over and over again, not to divorce. And finally, if the believer absolutely insists on it, the believing spouse is not enslaved. Enslaved to what? Well, the command not to divorce. And notice then that Paul's teaching in verses 12 to 16 then lines up perfectly with what Jesus had commanded in verses 10 to 11, that there be no divorce. But remember, Jesus had envisioned that a divorce might take place nevertheless. And so Paul calls for peace here in the midst of the divorce, but not for remarriage. To go back to Jesus' command in verses 10 to 11, the spouse is to remain single in that circumstance or be reconciled to her former spouse. Nowhere does Jesus or Paul say that the wife is free to remarry or that she's no longer bound. Now, going back to that not enslaved language, that was used by Stoics and Cynic philosophers of the day. And the idea was that marriage was kind of like slavery. So if we're going to say here that a spouse is no longer enslaved, well, wouldn't that be good to remain single then and in an unenslaved state? So again, everything's pointing to remaining single after the divorce. So to sum this all up, Paul's not mentioning remarriage here. It's not even provided as an option. Paul's admitted opinion here is not overturning Jesus' explicit command. They're in agreement. He's just letting the believer allow the non-believer to go through with the divorce, like they have any say over it. I mean, usually it's just a simple separation, and that's divorce in the ancient world.
So given that, it makes me think of a text like 1 Timothy 3:2, where I've heard on numerous occasions, you know, the qualifications for elder, he's a one-woman man, and that being just, well, you're faithful to your spouse, and you don't have more than, you know, one wife sort of thing. You don't have seven wives, polygamous. So if this is the case about how he thinks about it, might this also be referring to divorce and remarriage as well, to where he can't be remarried?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the requirements you have there for a church leader. It's both the overseer, it's also for the elder there in 1 Timothy 3, that they are to be, if you will, literally a one-woman man. And it seems to me that I think that marital status, having only a single spouse, makes the best sense of that verse. In other words, that those laboring in public ministry are to be one spouse people. We actually have a couple parallels to that very language in inscriptions from the day that'll talk about a one man woman or a one man spouse. You have 1 Timothy 5, the one man woman there with these elderly real widows. But in both instances, this is about being limited to a single spouse in the course of that spouse's lifetime. And so it's really important to go back to those inscriptions in those Roman traditions of Univira that render this an understandable teaching. But also, why did Pastoral Paul come to this point of view? Well, you see it elsewhere in the New Testament that remarriage is being permitted. These are exemplary characteristics here in 1 Timothy 3. It's not just for church leaders, but it's also for all Christians, even as Jesus teaching elsewhere in the Gospels.
So I just looked up something because I was curious. And in Westminster Confession, it basically gives the opportunity in the case of adultery after marriage, it's lawful for the innocent party to sue out a divorce and after the divorce to marry another as if the offending party were dead. There's nothing like that in the early church based on what you've researched, right?
Right. Well, this is the thing. The notion that you treat your partner of in a divorce as if they were dead is not just the Westminster Confession, but also goes back to Luther and the very beginning of the Reformation. So it was a common way of justifying since stoning of the adulterer was no longer being practiced in the first century, then all we can do is treat that person as if they were stoned. And if they're dead, then you're free from your spouse and can marry again. It's an ingenious justification for remarriage, if only the scriptures had said that. I mean, you do have these confessions, like we have it in Lutheranism too, where you'll have in the treatise on the power and the primacy of the Pope by Melanchthon, where it's unlike the Westminster Confession. This is not a dedicated confession on this topic, but he'll mention in passing when he's talking about the duties of bishops versus the duties of the secular authorities. He'll say, well, we condemn all these human traditions that the bishops in the Catholic Church have made up. And he lists a bunch of traditions that are in his mind silly and includes preventing the marrying, remarriage of spouses. But if this is biblical, then it just wouldn't be a nice example of a human tradition. So you wouldn't have a dedicated confession at this point, at least for the Lutheran reformers, like you would for the Reformed. It's a tough thing for we moderns, especially since the Reformation is following that famous humanist Erasmus that provided a jumping point for the reformers.
And now I'm even more curious to go find out more stuff, because I just looked up the London Baptist Confession and it removes that section about divorce. And so I'm wondering if that was intentional because they had differing opinions on this. Now I've got to go find that out, and whoever's listening can go find that out. Now I am curious if this is true about the nature of remarriage. I know, you know, a lot of Christians object to no-fault divorces, and they would say, you know, let's do what we can to remove the ability to do that. But if it's true that Christians should say no remarriage at all, should we also similarly try to remove the ability to remarry, at least somehow within the bounds of the church, being more seriously committed to prohibiting this?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult when you talk about no-fault divorce, I mean, it is difficult for church leaders to discern where the innocence or guilt lies in a marriage or divorce. We're just not behind those closed doors. Divorce for adultery, at least, would involve what has become a public sin, as would if the spouse is publicly forcing the divorce on the other and is an unbeliever in these instances. You see this evolution, though, in church teaching throughout the 20th century, where we went from divorce for specific instances to no-fault divorce as being the basis of our Christian teaching. But if Scripture is only providing limited grounds for divorce and Jesus is teaching that it's sinful and adulterous, certainly many Christians, if you're taking your cues from the biblical text, will end up finding themselves objecting to the concept of a no-fault divorce. Certainly as for remarriage, if Scripture teaches that remarriage is forbidden, if that is to be normative for modern practice, then the church certainly wouldn't be in the business of or sanctioning remarriages of the divorced while the former spouse still lived. So this is obviously going to be very countercultural within our larger world, even within other churches, other church bodies. But I mean, welcome to the first couple centuries of Christianity when Christianity itself was exceedingly countercultural prior to 325. So what then can a Christian say in the public arena? In the public arena, at least outside the church, you could say that God in his creation intended for one man to be united with one woman, since that's what Jesus says earlier in Matthew chapter 19. It's in Mark chapter 10. Jesus says it's built into creation. And so society can disagree. They can practice otherwise, but that's just what these scriptures would require us to confess as God's will for our world and creation. So we just have to stand firm on this is God's will for humanity.
So given your work, I mean, do you have any sample pastoral cases or examples that might help with pastors navigating these waters in particular, especially if, you know, they become convinced that this is true, this is right? That's probably going to be a shift given their own context and the people in their church. How do you think they should go about working through this?
Well, I offer statistics at the beginning of the book demonstrating that whether you're in a church or you're outside of it, it doesn't really matter. The statistics are actually the same, surprisingly. One third of all the married couples you see there are instances where one or even both of the spouses have remarried after divorce. So if you're going to say that remarriage is adulterous, if the spouse is still alive, former spouse, you're going to have a lot of angry people there. We just don't have modern churches taking this position. I mean, Pope Francis in the 2010s had a church council, and they're allowing for much more, they're moving toward more acceptance of the remarried in Catholic circles. Not that they would perform the remarriage, but more acceptance of it once it's taken place. I mean, the question here really is, if remarriage is adulterous, then what is a pastor or minister to do? We have you asked for a sample pastoral case. The only one I can think of would be John Piper. He's a Pauline scholar, wrote a dissertation on Romans 9, started a church in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, Bethlehem Baptist Church. And if you look online, you'll find their original position statement on divorce remarriage, which reflected his view, is that remarriage is not permitted while the divorced spouse is still alive. That was their church's position back in the late 1980s. But then you'll notice that over time, their church leadership decided to move away from that original position of Piper's. It was just too countercultural. And so you have people in his own church writing against him on this topic and publishing against him. So, you know, the thing is, if a pastor or minister is going to say that remarriage is adulterous, as I think to me, I just can't find a way to avoid the conclusion. And really, I would be the first person to love for there to be an exception. I mean, it's in agreement with my own church's tradition. I'd really prefer it that way. I mean, this is against the grain for me personally to take this thesis. But if you're going to go out and then as a pastor take that position at church, I mean, assuming you don't get run out of your church here for the teaching, which I think is a real possibility, you have to realize that this teaching is against what church bodies are teaching. And so you'd have to emphasize this goes back the first several hundred years of Christianity, but not today. So naturally, then the question becomes, so for people who have remarried, because you know, one third of the marriages in front of you, they have, well, should then they dissolve their marriage and go back to their former spouse, or should they stay in that marriage? I mean, if they stay in that marriage, would that be continuing to adulterate? Is adulterating an ongoing sin there should be stopped? The marriage should be stopped. Well, it's important for the remarried to recognize that adultery is involved in the remarriage. But after confessing that sin, what do you do about the situation, about the remarriage? We have to remember that Deuteronomy chapter 24, 1 through 4, back in the Torah had said that a woman who had married another man was not permitted to go back to her former spouse. And the text says that would be an abomination. So a return to the original spouse was not an option for them. But also keep in mind that divorce and remarriage, as we've seen, were quite common in Jesus and Paul's day. So isn't it interesting that neither Jesus nor Paul ever asked those who've been remarried to leave their spouses and go back to their former ones? Even the first 300 years of Christianity, one just does not see a requirement that remarried people divorce and return to their original spouses. And I think that the absence is conspicuous. And I think it likely reflects the influence of Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4 on their thinking. Now, in the Gospels, in John chapter 4, we find Jesus shaming the Samaritan woman at the well for having had five husbands. And the man she currently was with wasn't her husband. He shames her for it, but he still recognizes that she had these five husbands. You know, the prohibition here in Matthew 19 is let not human beings separate what God has joined together. In other words, you really can do this. There can be this divorce. So a modern pastor would want to urge the remarried to repent of the sin. It's stress it's a rather serious sin here. And then to draw on the language of Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, although he's not using it for this particular instance, but it would apply, stay as you are. Stay as you are and then honor God with where you find yourself.
That's super helpful. So the last thing I want to know is if there was anything in your argument that you think is the weakest link that somebody could push back on and say, and maybe convince you otherwise, what might it be?
I don't know of a weak link. I would like for there to be one. I think the thing here at this point, though, is to look at, while I can't find a missing link, I'm just a single scholar. So what'll be interesting to see is this because this book is so countercultural, I say at the very end, it's likely to generate a lot of bad press, London Lyceum notwithstanding, but there are going to be some people who are going to be really hostile to the thesis. They're going to feel judged by it, that remarriage is adultery. I think it's a very difficult thesis. I don't know a way around it. So we'll just see as at least we restarted the conversation, as more people put their heads together and think about this, we'll see the reviews of the book and see if there are some substantive objections that we need to rework. I'm just not aware of them at this point. If I did, I'd freely put them in the book.
Yeah, no, I feel like I've seen a couple of people sharing the work recently. And I don't remember who it was. I have the sense that Tom Schreiner shared it.
Yes.
And was very interested in it, and at least mentioned something along the lines of, considering the thesis. So I think it'll be interesting. I am very interested to see the reception of it overall.
Tom emailed me. He said, because we work together on the Christian Standard Bible, it's the most literal and word for word, at the same time, the most readable English translation in print. It's just the best translation in English, from what we can tell by the statistics. We worked together on it years ago. I didn't have any interest in the project, but he told me I had to do it, so I did it. But at the time when we were working on it, I asked him about this topic. I said, so what are your I can't find a way to justify it. What are your reasons? And so you'll find online that Tom has a couple recorded sessions he's done for Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, where he serves as a professor and a dean, where he justifies remarriage after divorce and explains it. What he said to me is that after reading the book, he just can't find a good reason for remarriage after divorce. So he's been recommending the book. But, I think his opinion, as mine, is that, we just need to wait and see how people receive the thesis here.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I've always appreciated Tom because I've found that he is willing to change his mind on things if he's given evidence. So I always respect that in a scholar who's willing to do that.
Biblical scholar in the truest sense.
Yeah. So tell me, for those who are interested in just your work in general, is there a good place to go to find the other books you've mentioned that you've been writing and other projects that you have coming down?
Yeah. If your listeners are intrigued, my intention, I have a website. It's Andrew Doss with no space in there. AndrewDass as in Sam, AndrewDass.net. It's my website. And I have a listing of the Remarriage of Christianity. It's my intention as time goes on to create a link to, discussion, it's kind of some further discussion on this topic. And so I'm hoping to give links to, this London Lyceum broadcast, some others, and then so people could go there and find in that. And you'll find there also the other books I've written and what people have said about them. So you can explore more about me as a scholar on that site.
Awesome. Well, this has been great. I really enjoyed it. And as a reminder for those who are listening, I've got the link to this particular book, as well as I'll make sure the link to Dr. Doss's website is there, so you can click on those and explore them and find the other resources that are available. Thanks for everybody for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you all soon.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.